You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. With the COVID-19 pandemic closing schools, parents are now having to serve as teachers for their children. Coming up, our guest says while she's making a good faith effort to have her sons do their homework, she explains why she's refusing to try to recreate the school experience for them. Also, listener support is the largest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. That's a big deal. This spring member drive, support the programs you value. You can give right now at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. And thanks for your support. Now, Wisconsin's election results are being counted today, but there are still some big questions about who was able to participate last week and which ballots can be counted. There have been reports across the state of ballots that were supposed to be mailed to voters but never got delivered, and some absentee ballots that were mailed back to local officials that have problems with the postmarks. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She's been following all of this. Laurel, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, Laurel, I'm going to put a timestamp on this one. We're talking just after 4 o'clock. If people are listening later or streaming this later online, some of this may have changed by then. But what's going on with the votes this afternoon slash evening?
Well, we are in a little bit of an official limbo period right now. Not like we haven't been in limbo for the past week or so. This has been a very odd election. Obviously, we had votes on Tuesday. Now we're going to get our official results tonight or start getting those results. I think what we're particularly keeping an eye out for, of course, in addition to who wins, is how many people were able to vote for this election. That was obviously a huge conversation, people coming out to vote in person, people requesting absentee ballots. And more, I think most recently, kind of this conflict over which absentee ballots are going to be counted because of some conflict over postmarks or the actual date on which clerks across the state actually received them.
Well, let's take those one at a time, Laurel. We'd heard anecdotal reports over the last week and a half or so of people who say they requested absentee ballots at some point in March or April, never got them. Now we're hearing about undelivered ballots across the state. Can you round up some of the places that apparently had issues?
Mm-hmm. So I think the first one that we heard about was Fox Point, where there were a number of ballots that had just been continually coming back to the clerk there. So they had been trying to put them in the mail, send them out to voters so voters could obviously fill them out and get them back in time. But they just kept being sort of bounced back to the clerk and weren't making their way really at all through the Postal Service. We know there had been some ballots that had been recovered. I think it's three tubs of ballots that had been intended for voters in Oshkosh and another community in that part of the state. I think they were actually uncovered at a sorting facility in Milwaukee, where often things are routed. So we know that there have been certainly some issues in addition to, you know, ballots getting back to election officials to process them and whether they have the necessary markings on them and meet all those ballot requirements, but just ballots making their way through the Postal Service and getting to the voter to begin with. So lots of kind of hurdles in each stage of the process for voters this year.
Now, I know both U.S. Senators Ron Johnson and Tammy Baldwin signed on to ask for an investigation of what happened with the mailing of those ballots. But part of the underlying story here, Laurel, is we had a lot of people requesting absentee ballots for this election, right?
Oh, absolutely. We had more than 1 million people request absentee ballots for this election. I think the total ended up being about 1.2 million. That's just a huge jump from anything that we've ever seen before. According to data from the State Elections Commission, about 1 million of those had been returned to clerks. A little bit of the uncertainty right now is ballots that have been returned to clerks but might not end up being counted. Because of different kind of variations in postmarks, which is something that was introduced into the whole scenario through a U.S. Supreme Court ruling about our election.
Right. Let's talk about that postmark issue. Where did it end up falling? There were a couple changes as this moved through the courts of when votes had to be mailed and postmarked, right?
Right. So kind of the way that it played out through a series of different court decisions were that at first Wisconsin voters were, you know, held by the previous deadline that we've always had, which was ballots needed to be in the possession of clerks by 8 p.m. on election day, whether that was, you know, delivering those mail-in ballots in person, you know, deciding to run them to the clerk's office or the polling place if you're worried about the Postal Service, or, you know, sending them through the mail and the clerk having them by that time. Under a federal court decision, that deadline was actually extended until today, April 13th, at 4 p.m. And that decision said it didn't matter when the ballot was postmarked by the voter, just as long as it was received today by 4 p.m. And that was something put into place because a lot of folks had raised concerns about delays in the Postal Service, this sort of huge influx of mail-in ballots, as I mentioned, just an unprecedented number of these absentee ballots, clerks kind of grappling with how to handle this situation, voters figuring out the process for the first time. So the court granted this 6-day or so leeway. But Republican state lawmakers weren't comfortable with that. They said that it, you know, raised some concerns for them in terms of voter fraud, ballots being mailed after Election Day, and what sort of implications that might have, you know, if results came out or anything like that, that might influence folks who were still wanting to cast a ballot. Even though the federal court judge had actually barred clerks from releasing any unofficial results or certainly official results until the 13th. So Republicans appealed that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court is what introduced that postmark requirement, saying that ballots, in order to be counted, needed to be postmarked on or before Election Day. They could be received up until today, accounting for some of those delays, but they needed to have that April 7th or before postmark.
Talking to Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, about some of the latest concerns about Wisconsin's election last week, votes being counted probably as we speak. So, Laurel, it's possible that if somebody sent in that ballot on time, they did it, I don't know, the wrong post office or something, it didn't get that stamp, that cancellation. What happens to their vote then at a when it's being counted or, I guess, not counted?
Well, this is something that, is a unique scenario for folks that aren't, well-versed in postmarks. I certainly wasn't before I started covering this. But I have learned that postmarks don't necessarily have a date on them. Some postmarks that clerks are receiving and have received over the past several days have had a month on them. They'll say April 2020, or they'll have a postmark that doesn't have any date at all. So they're technically postmarked, but they're not postmarked by April 7th. And so clerks have gone to the State Elections Commission saying, how do we know if these ballots qualify in order to be counted under the U.S. Supreme Court ruling if they say something like April 2020, or the stamp was kind of unevenly applied, so you can't read all of it, you can't really tell the date. There was some guidance issued last Friday from the Elections Commission that kind of just clarified the Supreme Court ruling, but also said if it has that April 2020 stamp, and clerks can get kind of a sworn statement from their Postal Service person saying that it was in the possession of the post office by Election Day, then it can be counted. But a lot of ballots don't even have that April 2020 mark. They have something different. So what's happening right now, like you said, as we speak, clerks around the state are looking at these ballots and deciding which ones qualify and which ones don't, kind of on a case-by-case basis.
We'll be watching right along with you, Laurel. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's Laurel White, State Capitol reporter for WPR. She was with us today to talk about issues with absentee ballots in last week's statewide spring election. For results, you can hear updates on the latest today on WPR and at WPR.org. We'll break down the results tomorrow, what we know at that point anyway, at 3:45 on Central Time. Coming up, a Wisconsin teacher wanted to encourage people to share a little joy and connection during this time of physical distancing. We will learn about the Happy Heart Hunt. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the Happy Heart Hunt began with when a Wisconsin teacher thought we could all use a little joy during this challenging time. After just a few weeks, the group's Facebook page has over 250,000 members around the world. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about anticipating a better tomorrow.
People are using a lot of coping mechanisms to get through these days. For writer Jan Larson, it's hope, faith, and love.
Today is my birthday. I could joke and claim the whole of Wisconsin shut down in celebration, dancing in the streets to follow. But that wouldn't be true. Hashtag safer at home. Instead, I'll tell you that I woke with a singular word rolling around in my head. Hope. As I lay in bed, unwilling to acknowledge the white-gray sky and the dirt-flecked snow of March receding into the pine trees that line our property, I glanced up and smiled. Above our bedroom closet, I had, as a young mother, stenciled three clusters of pansies in shades of blue, yellow, violet, and red, one bouquet for each of the three children I didn't know we'd have, but for whom we hoped. The stenciled art was an attempt to remind me of the spring that would follow the long Wisconsin winters. I don't often remember they are there, but today they greeted me with the promise of spring. These delicate flowers made me hope for more than the blooms that spring invariably brings. I hope for, I expect, a time when the distance will fade and the virtual hugs we send our now young adult children will be replaced with open arms and heads nestled close to our hearts. Hope. It's a word that works well with others. I can't think of hope without bumping into faith and love. Like the ivy that twists its way through the pansies on my wall, these words are linked. They are my heritage, the legacy from my pastor father who spent his adult life and my childhood tramping through cotton fields among migrant farm workers and later city barrios to proclaim hope. My mother, his partner, his confidant, his counselor, had a depth of faith that sustained her in her middle years and beyond when she struggled with illness that sometimes succeeded in severing her hold on reality. Faith, complete trust and confidence. After my parents died in a car accident, one of my siblings sent me the Bibles they had carried with them. My mother's constant companion sat by my nightstand for more than a year before I could bring myself to open it. When I unzipped the fabric cover, bits of twig and leaves, remnants of the crash that had somehow worked their way into cracks and crevices, fell from its pages. The inside front covers bore her beautiful, precise handwriting and a long list of favored verses. Verses of faith, hope, and love. Verses that she shared with me as a child when others ridiculed and rejected me. As I reread them, I was reminded of the hope, of the expectation that someday there would be love. Love. Well, we recognize it when we see it. I found that love in the eyes of a man who has been my partner, confidant, counselor, and friend for more than 30 years. His love is more than a feeling. It is a choice, a daily act on his part to be that person who loves me unconditionally. As I face the final year of my fifth decade, a time of great uncertainty for the entire planet, I am able to draw on a lifetime of faith, hope, and love. Together, they will allow me to weather the storm that has engulfed us all. I hope the same for you.
Writer Jan Larson is the chair of the Communication and Journalism Department at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, for many of us, it's been about a month since we've been able to be around friends and family, even with holidays or happy hours hosted through video conferences or good old-fashioned phone calls. It can be easy to get a little down as we work our way through a time of isolation. But there have also been some really creative responses to the need to stay at a distance from others. Leslie Brissett is a first grade teacher at Milton Elementary School. She's the founder of the Happy Heart Hunt group on Facebook, where people share pictures of homemade hearts on their windows. Leslie, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, where did the inspiration for the Happy Heart Hunt come from?
I would love to take full credit for it. However, it was sort of an idea that was floating around Facebook and social media. Some different groups had put out some ideas about, you know, hanging things in your window. It had gone from shamrocks, and then all of a sudden it was this, you know, COVID-19 heart thing. And I thought, why not make a Facebook page so everybody could share together and see what was out there? And that's kind of where it came from.
And what's your hope? What are the goals for this, having these hearts up on windows and the windows up on social media?
I think it's just to bring everybody together, to give everybody something, uplifting to look at. You know, the news can be kind of draining sometimes, and sometimes you just need something happy to look at, something to uplift you. And also just to show everybody that we're all in this together and, you know, we have things that connect us even though we're apart right now.
If somebody wants to play along at home, what do they do?
Yeah. If you want to do this at home, basically you just create some sort of heart decoration and hang it in your window. It's been going on since March 18th, so people have gotten pretty creative. We now have heart chalk drawings and just all kinds of amazing things. But if you go to the page, the Happy Heart Hunt page on Facebook, and just look at the feed and see all the stuff, you'll get lots of inspiration. There's so much cool stuff out there.
And you've got some simple rules. People have to be positive here, and it's got to be hearts. It's not something other than hearts. It's hearts.
Right. Well, yeah, it's definitely hearts and handmade hearts. You know, I can tell you that I've seen about 4,000 heart-shaped potatoes at this point, which is super cool. And I think there are other pages that, you know, are about that kind of thing. But ours is really about that homemade feeling of being able to have something that people see you put time and effort into. It doesn't have to be, you know, amazing. You'll see some pictures that people have really been very artistic. Mine happened to be made out of gift bags because I didn't have anything and I'm not super artistic, but that's, you know, not really the point. But yes, it has to be homemade and something that you're putting out there for the Happy Heart Hunt.
Well, I want to talk about the response now. And before we get to where you are now, first, just locally, what was the reaction when you first started doing this?
Well, locally, you know, I'm a teacher. And so a lot, it, you know, spread throughout sort of the school community and then our students here in town. And then it just all of a sudden started to blow up. So a lot of people in town, I think, are pretty happy and proud that it started here in our little town of Milton, Wisconsin, and now has pretty much gone worldwide.
Yeah. Talk about where you're seeing hearts coming in from now.
Everywhere. I think we have like over 99 countries. You know, obviously the most are in America, but we have Canada and the UK and South Africa and Norway and France and pretty much anywhere you can imagine. There's probably a heart in at least one window.
And you've got, I think I looked this morning, over 250,000 members now on the Facebook page.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I looked, it was like 256,000 something.
Wow.
Last night. So yeah.
Did you expect it to go that far?
No, not at all. I remember people, you know, texting me like, oh my gosh, you're going to hit 500. And, oh, are you watching? You're ready to hit 1,000. And now it's just like, okay, we don't need to look anymore.
And well, not just looking at the pictures themselves, but it seems like people are really feeling this as a positive thing and having a sense of community, you know, whether they're in your neighborhood in Milton or whether they're, as you say, on the other side of the planet.
Yeah, a lot of people are commenting, you know, this is the bright side point of my day. I love coming here and looking at all of the happy hearts and the happy words that people have for each other. We have a lot of people thanking, you know, our essential workers and nurses and doctors and such, and just really giving people a place where they can go and show their appreciation, even though they're sort of stuck at home.
I don't know how much you're able to go out and walk around or drive around your community, but when you're out in the physical world, are you seeing a lot of hearts on local windows?
I am. And, you know, I would have thought that, you know, it's sort of past Milton. It's been around for quite a while now, you know, that people, but every time I go, you know, for a drive or run to the grocery store for milk or whatever, I see another house with more hearts up. So it's still spreading.
And I've seen some of the messages on your Facebook page are people are dedicating hearts. You know, this one is for the nurses. This one's for first responders. This one's for grocery workers, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
People are using this as a way to kind of give shout outs to people whose work they appreciate now.
Yeah, definitely. Especially if there's somebody in their family, you know, long haul truckers. I saw one for them the other day. I think it's just they just want to say thanks and they want to get it out to a big audience. And now they have this big audience on this Facebook page with all these people.
Well, Leslie, what are you hoping people get out of this?
I just hope that people stay positive. I mean, I think it's that, you know, things can quickly turn negative when people start thinking about things in not a positive way. And so I think hoping that people just go here if they need that time to take a break and think about positives.
And before I let you go, Leslie, you mentioned you turned some, I think, wrapping paper into hearts. Now, would you just have,
yeah,
a couple hearts on a window, or have you done what some of the people did and have, hearts all over the place?
No, I'm not real artistic, and I don't have small children in my house. I have a teenager. So, we just have basic hearts in our window, and I did make a poster that says, Happy Heart Hunt Facebook, just so people driving by might know where to look if they were wondering why I had these hearts in my window.
Fantastic. Leslie, thank you so much for sharing this with us.
You're so welcome.
Leslie Brissett is a first grade teacher at Milton Elementary School and founder of the Happy Heart Hunt group on Facebook. You can also go to the Ideas Network Facebook page and see some of the happy hearts that our listeners have posted, and you can add your own too. Coming up, we'll talk with a mom about why she says she's refusing to play the role of teacher after her twin boys' school was closed because of COVID-19. Also, listener support is the biggest source of funding for the Ideas Network. That is a big deal. One listener from Madison made a gift and said, "Thank you for keeping people informed." This spring member drive, you can support the programs that you value. Give. It takes just a few minutes. You can call 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or go online and give at WPR.org. And thank you so much for your support now and through the decades. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show, a lot of elective medical procedures are postponed for now, but some things can't be delayed. Giving birth is one of those. Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at pregnancy and childbirth during the pandemic. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. WPR is a big part of your day, your go-to for essential news, in-depth analysis of important issues, and for great entertainment. And listeners like you are the biggest source of funding for Wisconsin Public Radio. We're in our spring member drive. Your gift now supports Central Time and all the other WPR programs you rely on today and every day. You can give now. Support the Ideas Network at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or go online at WPR.org and thank you. Now, schools in Wisconsin are closed until, at the very least, April 24th. That's a week from Thursday. Governor Evers ordered them closed as part of his Safer at Home order to fight the spread of the coronavirus. The move has resulted in many students trying to learn from home with tablets or laptops. Parents are also playing an increased role in teaching kids, in addition to working from home themselves in many cases. It's pretty much anybody's guess when schools will reopen. But our next guest says she's not interested in turning her home into a substitute for her twin boys' school, and that, yeah, it's going to be kind of messy, but she says everything's going to turn out okay. Jenny Weiner is an associate professor of educational leadership at the University of Connecticut. She recently wrote about her approach to her kids' schooling in the New York Times. Jenny, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Jenny, your kids, you're a fellow twin parent, by the way. That's cool. Your kids are in third grade. What does school, I'm throwing quotes around that, look like for them right now?
Yeah, thanks for asking. So school looks like about in the mornings we wake up, we have a dog, we walk our dog, and then we have basically half an hour blocks of activities, whether they be math. There's some worksheets. The school now is sort of more up and running in terms of distributing some resources to us. And then they do what we're calling exploration, which we give them sort of free rein to investigate a question that they're interested in. So they go on the internet, we side-eye to make sure everything is appropriate, and they have to come up with 5 facts and 2 questions. Then we take about 10 o'clock, almost 2-hour break, which involves mostly trying to get energy out, whether that's doing yoga online or going for a walk or going for a bike ride with our newly minted masks. We have lunch. We attempt to do some other kind of learning activity, maybe for 30 or 40 minutes in the afternoon. And then around, I would say, like 2 or 3 o'clock, it's a free for all. We have video games. We have TV. I'm trying to get them to watch more like documentaries. And then we have dinner, and we try to keep bedtime pretty much where it was before, which is about 8 o'clock.
That sounds like a lot. And you write in your piece, though, that you aren't, and you think most people shouldn't, adapt, you know, kind of a high pressure approach to feel like home is school now. How do you see yourself and others hopefully drawing that line?
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, first of all, I would never sort of presuppose that the way it works for us should be the way it works for others. Sure. And I think that's sort of the messiness, right? Like everyone is going to have to find a way to make it work for them that's most appropriate and make sense for their family, for their sanity and well-being. In terms of sort of the line for us, I should also add that one of my sons has a disability. So he gets special services at school, quite a few. So school for him, you know, I'm putting sort of air quotes around that, doesn't involve one teacher and one student or one teacher and a group of students. It involves an entire kind of collaborative group of working professionals to make school available to him and allow him to be successful. So that, of course, complicates, right, our ability as parents. We're not 8 people nor trained, you know, elementary school educators to be able to facilitate that for him. And so I think the line is, when it feels that you are having opportunities to express learning and love and joy, and that it's helping you and your children feel better in a structured environment, then I say, go for it. You know, I mean, that's been my, or I have said to myself, go for it. I think the line is when it feels like you're trying to create the structures, compliance, accountability of school within this sort of crisis situation within your home without necessarily the skills, knowledge, or capabilities to do so, which I can't understand how it create anything other than additional stress, potentially like a negative relationship with your child in a time where, you know, the humanness and the love need to be sort of at the forefront to deal with the pandemic. And so that's sort of how I was conceptualizing and thinking about it, rather than sort of dictating one should be spending their time in this way or another.
Jenny Wiener is with us from the University of Connecticut. We're talking about a piece she wrote about parenting during a time of COVID-19, staying at home, and how parents are handling education for kids at home. Want to hear from you, by the way, at 800-642-1234. If you and your family are in this situation, we'd love to hear your unique experience. It's going to be different from household to household. Want to hear how you're handling things, how much pressure you're putting on the educational side of things, how much slack you're giving yourself, your kid, or if you're the kid yourself, call in at 800-642-1234. Jenny, a word you used in your piece and you've used here today, messy. This has got to be messy, and It seems like the more we appreciate that, the better off we're going to be.
Totally. And I, you know, I sort of think back, and as a twin parent too, you know, I had all these idyllic ideas about when I brought my babies home, like what that would look like. And very quickly, sort of any expectation of how they behaved was useful for about 8 hours. And then they would change and something would go wrong. And I think, you know, that degree of messiness sort of readied me for this, in the sense that like what works today or for this half an hour or for this, you know, afternoon may not work tomorrow. And instead of sort of punishing oneself, particularly when we have this additional stress and unprecedented environment of the pandemic, why not sort of just say, like, I give myself permission to negotiate this as it comes. And I think that at least for us has created opportunities to just go off course, but in, you know, exciting or interesting or, you know, new ways that as a family we maybe hadn't brokered before, rather than trying to double down on things that aren't working because somebody told us or we feel that we should or have to.
Now, in my family, we're in the high school zone, and I think you mentioned your piece for people looking at, you know, maybe college. This can be stressful in a different way. Are kids missing out on the stuff that's going to get them into whatever school they want to go to, or their parents want them to go to, whatever the case may be? How do you think people can dial down some of that particular style of stress?
Yeah, that's a great issue. And I think that those are really legitimate fears, because we live in a society where sort of education is transactional. Like, people have to get these awards or get a certain amount of APs to be able to feel successful. I mean, I think what's hard right now is there is no guidebook, right? So we have to sort of embrace the messiness. We have to hold that for ourselves and for our kids, and sort of just say to them, you know, maybe this means that it's going to be a little bit longer. Maybe this means that we're going to have to think about, you know, learning differently. And I know that those aren't easy answers, but again, this is an unprecedented time. And I just don't know what help it is to pretend like everything is normal outside the scope of your home, how that might actually increase stress and anxiety for your child, and particularly teenagers who feel, again, this amazing pressure to perform. So, you know, I'm not there yet with my own kids, but I would love to hear what others are thinking about that, because I think it is a very difficult time for our older kids as well.
We are talking about parents and kids and how they're handling education at home while schools are closed because of the coronavirus outbreak. Jenny Weiner is with us, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership at the University of Connecticut and a parent herself. She says, as much as you can, you know, dial down the stress. Don't overload things in the household. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're experiencing this right now as a kid at home, a parent, or maybe a teacher working with kids and parents at home, it's going to be different from household to household, school from school. We'd love to hear how it's working for you. Do you feel this stress, this anxiety, or have you found ways to make it as positive an experience as you can? If you're listening, maybe you're busy parenting right now, but take a few moments to call in. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Are you assigning Ideas Network listening to your kids as an educational process? If not, why not? We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our discussion about distance learning and how families are dealing with it. Jenny Weiner is with us, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership at the University of Connecticut. She wrote a piece at the New York Times saying she's making a good faith effort to have her sons do their homework, but you can take it too far. She says, dial down some of the pressure on yourself and on your kids. You can join in at 800-642-1234 to share your experiences with learning while the schools are closed. You feeling stress and anxiety, or have you found a good rhythm, routine early in the game? 800-642-1234 is the number. Let's bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Chippewa Falls. Laura, hi.
Hi. So I have a senior in high school, and I also have a first grader. And my senior in high school obviously is very into technology. They do all of their homework mostly online anyway. But I have a first grader as well. And so we have started using the Chromebook. The teachers here are awesome, and they've already put out lesson plans. They do the meetings through Zoom. So lots of good stuff going up here, but it's always a challenge when you have a senior that wants to go to school and a first grader that is really bummed that she can't see her friends. So while we're getting the schoolwork done, we're also trying to navigate seeing friends and actually having a social life, which is really difficult this time of year.
Wow, it's a lot to juggle, Laura. Is it a battle sometimes with doing the homework so far, or are both your kids, that's quite an age spread, are both of them into doing the stuff online?
Yeah, they're really okay with doing it online. Like I said, my senior has already been doing homework online for even before the COVID pandemic. But my first grader, she's learning how to use her Chromebook, which she's very proud of herself because her big brother uses it as well. And then using Zoom and seeing all of her friends. And I'm learning as well. So I'm kind of going off of what my son is doing in high school and saying, hey, can you help me? Because I really don't know what I'm doing.
Good plan. Laura, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jenny, your thoughts on what Laura had to say?
Yeah, I think that's so wonderful. And I think what's so interesting is kids are missing the part of school that we can't provide, which is the social interaction and the humanness of the school. So, I mean, I think it's great that her kids are so willing and able. I would say, you know, one of the things to really think about is, you know, how can kids connect with each other in ways that are meaningful during this time? You know, there are other also sort of offline ways, writing letters. We started pen paling, writing to people who are in elderly homes that need, you know, that are unable to have visitors. And that's been incredibly rewarding, which isn't within the confines of a traditional school, but is doing good and is good for the kids.
Laura, thanks so much for calling in. I do appreciate it. Laura mentioned something that's really important here. Jenny, her first grader's learning the technology. Laura herself is using the technology, learning to use some of it. This is sounds like a good reason to cut ourselves a little bit of slack too, isn't it?
Absolutely. And I think, you know, some of the demands are, again, it's one thing if you had a lot of time to plan for, you know, knowing that everybody was going to go online and what that would look like. But, you know, I also have friends, her kids obviously of very different ages, but I have friends who have children of similar ages who are all simultaneously meant to go online at the same time in different classrooms, which of course requires an incredible amount of bandwidth for the parents and actually physically for technology and a different device for four kids. So you start to think about, wow, there are a lot of parameters that make this more or less accessible. And they're not just about sort of my knowledge as a parent or having the right equipment. There might be multiple factors that make it these technologies more or less available to different families.
Well, in our last minute or two, Jenny, can you leave us with some advice or words of encouragement for parents who are one of the many parents who are in this boat right now?
Yeah, I think my only words of advice might be about just compassion for yourself. Compassion for your kids and also compassion for educators. You know, one thing that that sparked for me when we were talking before is it's not that educators are serving kids or our parents. Like many of them happen to be both. You know, our teaching force remains primarily women, and many of those women have young children at home themselves or older children. So they're negotiating this entire working from home thing too, trying to create with excellence materials for your child. And how do we kind of convert that kind of empathy and compassion into advocacy once this will be over, because it will be over, and make sure that schools and children and teachers all over the United States have what they need to be successful every day.
Jenny, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, and safe, everybody. Stay home and just keep loving each other. That's the best we can do.
Thanks so much. That's Jenny Weiner, Associate Professor of Educational Leadership at the University of Connecticut. We talked to her about education during COVID-19 and why she says she refuses to run a coronavirus homeschool. She says, hey, everybody, you can cut yourself a little bit of slack as we're figuring this stuff out. You count on WPR for high-quality news, conversations, music, and inspiration. During our spring member drive, we have you and your feet covered. Support the programs you rely on and ask for your cozy Wisconsin Public Radio socks when you give $10 a month or more. Ask for those socks when you give at 888-202-2552 or WPR.org, and thank you. Today, clerks around the state are releasing results for the election Wisconsin held last week. Regardless of who wins, it was an historic event because it happened at a time when government is telling people to mostly stay home. That resulted in an election that made it harder to vote depending on where you were from and that experts say could have been avoided. Sean Johnson reports.
Last Tuesday, voters and poll workers covered themselves with face masks and gloves. Some wore plexiglass shields over their eyes. In Burlington, poll workers also wore blue aprons. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who spoke to WTMJ-TV that day, was among them.
People have been in pretty good spirits, happy to be able to vote, and at the same time, doing it in a way that's really safe.
Not everyone felt that way. Some voters told WPR and PBS Wisconsin that they were nervous, angry. Some were only there because they tried to vote absentee and their ballot never arrived. In Milwaukee and Green Bay, voters stood in line for hours.
We only have 5 polling places in the city, and I've been out here for almost 2 hours.
I'm not used to having a vote like this.
Frankly, I'm disgusted.
For the life of me, I don't understand why they can't get along in Madison.
So how did this happen? The Friday before the election, Democratic Governor Tony Evers called a special session of the legislature to delay the election and move it almost entirely to mail-in ballots. Republicans opposed this, so Evers tried to do it on his own.
I cannot in good conscience allow any types of gathering that would further the spread of this disease and to put more lives at risk.
The legislature, led by Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, challenged the move, and conservatives on the Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed and blocked the governor's order. Evers criticized the decisions, but for weeks he had made the same case. During regular media briefings, Evers said the April election was about making sure democracy would persist. The governor got asked about this a lot, including on March 30th, 1 week before he issued his executive order.
Governor, do we expect the election to happen as planned?
Well, there's nothing has changed from my vantage point.
By this point, poll workers, who'd been warned by the government about the health risks of large crowds, were dropping out. Milwaukee Election Commission Director Neil Albrecht says that was especially pronounced in his city, which is home to the majority of Wisconsin's African-American population and the bulk of its COVID-19 cases.
One of the factors that really has to be considered is that Milwaukee is really the epicenter of cases of COVID-19 in the state of Wisconsin.
Instead of the usual 180 polling places, Albrecht decided to open only 5 in what he called exceptionally large buildings, able to accommodate social distancing. He acknowledges that created lines. Voss has criticized Milwaukee's approach, but he said on Election Day that he thought people would look back and say Wisconsin did as well as it possibly could in the face of adversity. But public health experts don't see it that way. From Patrick Remington with the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
This went against all public health recommendations.
To Ryan Demmer at the University of Minnesota.
From a public health perspective, that is a potential disaster.
And it's made election law experts nervous, too.
I can't think of an election since 1965 that seems, again, from a process perspective, as much a failure as this one.
Ned Foley directs the election law program at Ohio State University's law school. During a podcast he co-hosts, Foley called Wisconsin's election tragic and avoidable.
What happened in Wisconsin is hugely worrisome because it makes us look like we don't care about our own democracy.
Foley says Wisconsin's COVID-19 election was severely discriminatory, and it could have been avoided by delaying the election long enough to vote entirely by mail. In his view, voting in person on April 7th set up a false choice between life and democracy. Foley says Wisconsin sacrificed both. Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll hear more about public health, COVID-19 in Wisconsin from one of the experts Sean cited in his story there. Patrick Remington joins us tomorrow for a look at the latest on testing, safer at home orders, and what comes next. You can support great reporting from Sean and the rest of the WPR news team by making a gift during our spring member drive here at WPR. You can call in at 888-202-2552. That's 888-202-2552. Or take just a few minutes to give online. Head over to our website. It's WPR.org. Thank you so much for your support. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, as I mentioned, we'll get the latest on the public health side of COVID-19, how the state and federal government are handling it, and you can join in with your thoughts and questions. If you're feeling stressed right now, getting some work in the yard or garden can make a difference, even some potted plants if a yard isn't an option. A gardening expert joins the show with some advice. And a guest shares some of the joys of swimming and why we humans seek out the water, whether it's a pool or a lake, which will hopefully be warm enough to swim in, you know, fairly soon. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent. Tomorrow at 7, Kate and her guests look at the developing results from last Tuesday's election and what we learned from an unusual election day. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then best-selling author Ann Patchett joins the show to share recommendations for reading right now, and we'll hear some of what you've been reading. You could share your current reading stack or suggestions over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.